Hello, Ed, and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what is behind the latest outburst of indignation from Hamid Karzai, who is upset with the US over the Taliban opening an office in Doha, Qatar. Thomas Barfield, the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History, joins us to discuss the behind-the-scenes wrangling ahead of possible peace talks on Afghanistan's future. Then we'll examine the implications of a move by the American Medical Association to declare obesity a disease. Dr. Robert Lustig, a pediatric endocrinologist and a leading expert on childhood obesity and author of Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity and Disease, joins us to discuss what this means for future medical treatment of a disease that afflicts one-third of America's adults, that's 78 million people, and 17% or 12 million of America's children, driving up medical costs by more than $150 billion a year. Then finally, we'll assess the defeat of the $950 billion farm bill today in the House that was voted down 234 to 195, largely because of the punitive cuts in food stamps that 50 million Americans depend on. Jim Weil, the president of the Food Research and Action Center, joins us to discuss the stigmatizing of needy Americans getting $1.50 per meal by Tea Party Republicans demanding that recipients of food stamps get jobs or have the federal money turned over to state governors to spend at their discretion. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who is a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you.
And this row that's broken out over the Taliban opening an office in Qatar, which I take it they sort of treated, and it looked as though, and perhaps the Qataris went along with this, I don't know, but it looked as though they were opening an embassy. They had a plaque on the building that said the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, and they had the Taliban flag flying above the building. And this has incensed Hamid Karzai, who is often at odds with the Americans. So how do you rate this latest outburst from him?
Well, this is typical of his sort of shoot first and ask questions later. I think probably a better approach from his point of view might have been a little more humor, that that's the best they could do. They're not going to get back in government. But I think the main thing he was concerned was that they were acting like a country, and he was afraid that the United States was about to negotiate them with them as a country, a government of a country. And I think he totally misread that. But nevertheless, given that he's been highly sensitive about wanting to control negotiations with the Taliban and not having the Americans work around him, it hit a sore spot.
Well, I think your point's well taken, Thomas Barfield, because it has essentially given a lot of publicity to the Taliban, which they otherwise would not have gotten. And isn't the Taliban's greatest concern that they have to have some legitimacy, because they have so little legitimacy, the rest of the world sees them as barbarians and women torturers, it looks as if this has fallen right into their lap.
It has, but they certainly knew how to take advantage of it, because it's not clear that anybody in Afghanistan sees them as an emirate, as a viable government looking to step in. I mean, this came across as sort of, we are a government in exile, waiting to measure the room so we can move in. And I think that to some extent they were deliberately sort of overplaying their position like that, in part because they have a number of internal problems, the whole question about what do they really want, are they willing to compromise, are they willing to be part of the political situation, or do they want to really return themselves to run the country by themselves, is a really open question even within their own movement.
Well, apparently, at the urging of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and the government of Qatar, the Taliban have taken the plaque off the building that said Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, and they've cut down the flagpole and lowered the flag, but they haven't taken it down altogether. So to what extent are there hosts here, Qatar, who along with Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia has always been a supporter of the Taliban going back to when they were in government. And so are there any sympathies there with the host government and the Saudis towards the Taliban, or have the Saudis gotten over it after al-Qaeda, et cetera?
Well, you have to remember that the Saudis actually broke diplomatic relations with the Taliban long before 9/11 because Mullah Omar insulted them. So even before the American invasion, the Saudis had sort of soured on Mullah Omar and the Taliban. I think one of the things is they may be in some sympathy with them and just didn't ask really hard questions about how, you know, what's our responsibility as sort of a neutral place to, you know, to set this up. I think there may have been some sympathy there, and therefore they didn't they really didn't think about what are the modalities here? How do we put this together? How do we be the interlocutors that bring these parties together? And I think in some ways the Taliban sort of stole a publicity march on both the Qataris and the Americans.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So just, I think it was last Tuesday that the NATO command in Kabul handed over the lead security responsibilities to the Afghan government ahead of the withdrawal of most of the foreign troops, which will be happening by the end of 2014. So this is an odd turn of events. This incident has rained on that parade, isn't it? This is something that Karzai wants to advertise, that he's in charge and the Americans are leaving.
Well, it's a little bit, and there's some people feel that Karzai believes that the Americans want to stay, and therefore he has the upper hand. I don't think he's really reading Washington politics really well, that this bilateral negotiation is not one in reality that the Afghans have a strong hand to play. After all, even when the troops are gone, it'll be the United States that's paying for their army and providing them sort of, even if they're not as large a number of troops, sort of a backup that would eventually prevent the Taliban from taking over militarily. And I think most Afghans sort of recognize that. So the idea that take your marbles and leave is actually, for the Karzai regime, an extremely dangerous mode. But he's of the opinion that the United States sees Afghanistan as so strategic that that they're the ones that will come back to the table. And I think one of the great dangers of that, as we saw in Iraq, is that politically, domestically, the United States might decide to wrap up its support and go.
Well, there's certainly no love lost, is there? We're between all the U.S. envoys have been so frustrated by Karzai, and at times he said stuff that it's endangered the lives of American troops, etc. I mean, they're pretty fed up with him, aren't they, across the board?
Yes, but since by the Afghan constitution, he has to step down after the 2014 elections, which are scheduled in April. Effectively, you're looking at, I think, from the American perspective, a change of leadership in less than a year. So their point of view would be that relationships are not between leader to leader, but state to state. And therefore, fundamentally, they're going to be looking at this with the government of Afghanistan and not necessarily looking at dealing with Hamid Karzai. So I'm certain there's some amount of patience there, knowing that even more critical for the Afghans in the withdrawal of foreign troops is the whole question, can power be transferred in Kabul? That would be the first time in Afghan history that it's transferred peacefully. So a lot of the Afghans are concerned, you know, because of this transfer of rulership of the country, will that move smoothly? So all of these pieces sort of come together.
So, Thomas Barfield, my understanding is that Pakistan's military and the ISI played an important role in convincing Afghan Taliban leaders to hold talks with the United States. And the U.S. is, after all, you know, they've already met secretly with them back in 2011. So it seems that the U.S. didn't get any kind of – obviously didn't get any guarantees out of the Taliban to stop killing Americans while they talk, right?
No, it's still an ongoing war. You know, this is neither side has really offered a ceasefire here. This is the beginning of negotiations. But I do think, particularly with the change of administration in Pakistan, a new civilian government taking charge, is that Pakistan may be rethinking just how advisable it is to sort of fully support the Taliban without negotiations, because they've got enough trouble within Pakistan. The so-called Pakistani Taliban are a threat to the government in Islamabad. History has sort of shown that both when Pakistan supported the Mujahideen against the Soviets and when they supported the Taliban, that that the Afghans make remarkably poor clients for Pakistan. That is, in a crunch, they don't take advice. So I think Pakistan may be concerned that it'd be better to come to an arrangement through negotiation than it would be to roll the dice to see just what could happen, because the unrest in the border provinces of Pakistan, the really horrible amount of terrorism that's taking place in Pakistan, I'm certain has caused them to rethink just how dangerous this is for themselves.
Well, you would think that it would be pretty obvious, wouldn't it, to at least to the sensible voices and people in Pakistan, that if the Taliban were to take over in Afghanistan, that would embolden the Tariq-e-Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, and they're already at war with the Pakistan government. So it's kind of mystifying as to why the Pakistan military and the ISI have supported the Taliban so much. It seems it's sort of the analogy would be, you know, feeding a guard dog and then eventually takes over the whole house and terrorizes the owner.
So it's more like feeding a tiger than a guard dog.
Right.
And yes, I think it's taken Pakistan a long time to realize that, and knowing that the foreign troops are coming out, I think they have been taking a strong look at it, and the realization that if you had civil war in Afghanistan, that would be very bad for Pakistan. I think they've probably also done a calculation that the Taliban are unlikely to simply sweep into Kabul to take over. There's sort of a lot of wishful thinking on that. Actually, if you look at Afghan insurgencies, historically, they're very good at getting rid of foreign armies that are in Afghanistan. They're remarkably poorly equipped then to get rid of the governments after the foreign troops leave. In all of Afghanistan's history, insurgencies have never gotten rid of a government that has international support. So, you know, and I think Pakistan may have realized that as well. One of the questions is, what are the Taliban thinking about the options? Do they think it's possible to get it all, or are they thinking, why don't we negotiate from a position of strength to get the best kind of deal that we can, rather than take it back to, for example, the 1990s? They pretty much destroyed Afghanistan in the civil war.
Well, today in the United Nations Security Council, Afghanistan and Pakistan traded accusations about terrorist sanctuaries on the border, and there have been artillery coming out of Pakistan into Afghanistan that's killed civilians. And there's obviously a great deal of bitterness between. I mean, it's a bit strange to me to understand how what this relationship is, even though Pakistan's obviously had enormous influence over Afghanistan. My impression is that not even the Pashtuns who make up the Taliban are particularly fond of the Pakistanis. Is that true?
That is true. I mean, Afghanistan was the only country to vote against Pakistan's entrance into the United Nations on the grounds it was an illegitimate state. It's never recognized the Durand Line border as a legitimate border, and the Taliban, when they were in power, didn't recognize that either. And historically, Kabul governments, regardless of who's been running them, have been open to power balancing politics such that Pakistan really worries that Kabul would reach out to Delhi to, you know, as a counterweight to Pakistan. But there's no love lost between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And one of the things you have to realize, while there's more Pashtuns in Pakistan than there are in Afghanistan, they constitute a small minority of Pakistan's 170 million people. So you've got these sort of funny balances, more Pashtuns than Afghanistan, but a small minority within the much larger Pakistani population. And so the great fear of Islamabad, too, is they have an insurgency on their own hands in Balochistan that's been running along. They certainly worry about the questions of holding the country together with the groups along the frontier that have never been happy with Islamabad's rule.
So aside from the Taliban, Thomas Barfield, you've got the Haqqani Network and you've got Hekmatyar, who's really a dangerous guy that the CIA used to support in the original Mujahideen jihad against the Soviets. And what happens to them, assuming that the Taliban, they can make some kind of deal with the Taliban and bring them into some kind of governance?
Well, one of the ironies of the Hizbi Islami, the party that Hekmatyar runs, half of that party is already in the Afghan government. A lot of Karzai's advisors are members of Hekmatyar's party. So you actually have this strange situation of a party leader running to destroy a government in Kabul and a number of his associates advising that government, holding positions and playing politics within that government. So that one's a very strange relationship. The Haqqanis, it's hard to know where they're going, but on the other hand, they've never really reached out, even during the Taliban time, to see themselves as rulers of Afghanistan. They've always cut a deal with who's ever most powerful in Afghanistan to essentially get regional autonomy, to be powerful, but without seeking to move out of their area into the urban areas or the larger agricultural areas. So it's hard to know, you know, where they would go, but they've shown probably the least interest in political deals, even though they're the ones that certainly do the most spectacular attacks on Kabul. But they've also had such a strong relationship with the Pakistani government, one doesn't really know sort of where their loyalty lies, whether it's to Mullah Omar or to the ISI.
Well, just in closing, Thomas Barfield, is the country going to return to a kind of warlordism, or do you think there's a possibility that they can have elections and create a stable government, and that the Taliban, you know, get some kind of representation in that government? They're clearly deluding themselves if they think they can take over the country. It sounds like their main sponsor is not interested in supporting them.
One of the questions is, number one, can there be a transition of power in Kabul in 2014? Is it possible to have elections? Will they be considered legitimate? Will it bring new blood into the government? People are watching that, and that's going to have important consequences for stability in Afghanistan. But one of the other things that people may be rethinking is that the government in Kabul is so highly centralized that the question of who holds the palace, who holds the presidency, you've got the whole government, which makes people very suspicious of negotiations with the Taliban. If they take over, they would have this highly centralized structure. Other people are looking, as part of this negotiation deal, perhaps change the structure of the government. So the Taliban are brought into coalitions, brought into rulerships in parts of southern Afghanistan, eastern Afghanistan, where they have more sympathy, but that they don't necessarily are not necessarily involved in a central government. And one of the ways to do that would be to devolve the central government so that not everything runs through the palace. And that would begin to secure the support of people in other parts of the country who also worry about who's going to be the leader. But if they control their own destiny more, then they may be less concerned about what's going on in Kabul. Right now, essentially, even though Karzai is a president, it's pretty much modeled on the Afghan constitution of King Zahir Shah. It's a constitution for a king. he appoints everybody, which is why people are concerned about it. But one of the things that Afghans may be rethinking is perhaps if the structure were changed a little bit, there would be some circuit breakers, so to speak. So if the Taliban were powerful or had the governor of Kandahar, people in Afghanistan would be, in other parts of the country, be less concerned if they had similar control in their own parts of the country. Not to go back to warlordism, but to go back to a situation where there's a little bit more balance, and then Kabul sort of is a mediator between the different regions, that it sort of handles a lot of the things that a state should do, but doesn't micromanage the politics of the whole country.
Well, Thomas Barfield, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back examining the implications of a move by the American Medical Association to declare obesity a disease. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Robert Lustig, who's a pediatric endocrinologist who has spent the last 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He's the director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at UCSF, Benioff's Children's Hospitals, and he's a member of the UCSF Institute for Health Policy Studies and a member of the Obesity Task Force of both the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society. His latest book is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Robert Lustig.
Thank you so much, Ian, for having me.
And do you think that this move by the American Medical Association to declare obesity a disease, which affects, one-third of Americans have this disease, that's 78 million American adults and 12 million American children, costing the health system over $150 billion a year.
Oh, it's a lot more than that.
So I take it.
Especially when you throw the diabetes on top of it.
Well, that's the part of it that we should start out and kind of pass this out. How do you separate out the disease of obesity then from the obesity related diseases,
right,
like diabetes type 2, cardiovascular disease, and certain cancers?
Indeed, this is exactly the issue. First of all, let me say that the American Medical Association declaring obesity as a disease at this point in time is sort of like, you know, being late to the party. In 2004, the Department of Health and Human Services under Tommy Thompson declared obesity a disease. In fact, he went on the Today Show, you know, very specifically to talk about, to state this back then. And yet all of the medical societies were silent at the time, which really made no sense whatsoever. The reason that they're doing this now almost assuredly is because they see Obamacare coming down the pike. And so, you know, by declaring it a disease, we can actually see reimbursement now for this. That's almost assuredly the reason. The big problem here is it's not about obesity, and it never was. Here's why. 20% of obese people are completely metabolically normal. They have no metabolic dysfunction. They will live a completely normal life, diet a completely normal age, cost the taxpayer nothing. They're just fat. Conversely, up to 40% of the normal weight population have the exact same metabolic dysfunctions as do the obese. They get type 2 diabetes. They get lipid problems. They get hypertension. They get cardiovascular disease. They get cancer. They get dementia. They end up costing the medical healthcare system even more than the obese do, and they don't even know they have a problem. So to say obesity is a disease is to be actually somewhat disingenuous, because actually normal weight people have the same problems. Third reason this is a problem is because obesity is not one disease. It's many. There are many different reasons for obesity. For instance, we have patients who have Cushing's disease, which is an excess of cortisol. They get obese. On the other hand, we have kids with Down syndrome or Prader-Willi syndrome. They get obese, but for a completely different reason. There are about 60 different diagnoses that lead to obesity. To call obesity a disease is not doing it justice, and what it's suggesting is, well, if there's one disease, there must be one treatment, and we know that's not true.
So the AMA's decision will essentially make diagnosis and treatment of obesity the obligation for a treating physician, won't it?
Right. Well, that should have been the obligation for the treating physician all along. Mm-hmm. So by them declaring a disease, it at least codifies the role of the physician in the health care of obesity. And that's good in a general global sense. But it's not going to help any individual because, hey, before today, we didn't have good diagnoses or treatments, and that's going to be true tomorrow as well. So, you know, in a sense, what it's doing is it's haranguing the physician to actually do something about it. The question is, what's causing it in the first place? Obviously, there are many different diagnoses, but none of them really explain what's happened over the last 30 years. How did the whole world get so obese so fast? And that's where the Western diet comes in. And that's, of course, what my book is about. And, you know, we're trying to fix the inadequacies and the inequities of the Western diet. And I can sum them up in, you know, a couple of words. Lack of fiber, high sugar, high omega-6s, low omega-3s, you know, that's a pretty good smattering of what's going on.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, who's a pediatric endocrinologist who spent the last 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He's the director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at UCSF and a member of the UCSF Institute for Health Policy Studies and a member of the Obesity Task Force on both the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society. And his latest book is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. So what kind of guidelines then are doctors going to have if the insurance companies and Medicare are already funding intensive behavioral therapy and putting a lot of money into bariatric surgery and treatment of diabetes, etc.? What about getting to the root cause, which you've just outlined? I mean, how much education is going to come into that?
Indeed, that is the $64 zillion question. The question is, how much proof do you need? You know, all the food industry, you know, keeps coming down and saying, you know, we don't have the research. We need more research. You know what that is? That's moving the goalposts. We have the research. We actually published a study 3 months ago in the journal Plus One that showed that sugar is the proximate cause of diabetes, irrespective of its calories and irrespective of obesity. It's diabetogenic all by itself, and it's 11 times more potent than total calories in inducing diabetes. So if that's the case, and this is causative, not correlative, then that is the clear way to start dealing with this problem. So to tell the physician, yes, obesity is a disease, and yes, now you're responsible for it, when the food industry has basically changed our environment in such a way as to foment these diseases, is really missing the mark.
Well, already the food industry is, you know, you talk about moving the goalposts. I've seen advertisements now of a housewife buying sugary drinks and saying they don't want big government telling them what she should be buying. And they've
exactly.
they've also got these disingenuous ads saying that there's more choice, less calories, less sugar in their soft drinks, but they're still selling basically the same product.
Of course, absolutely. Look, they're all saying, get your hands off my food, except for one thing, They've already been there. The fact is, we don't have the same diet we had 30 years ago because the food industry changed it. Of the 600,000 food items that are currently available in the American grocery store, 80% of them have added sugar, and that's on purpose because the food industry did it because they know when they do it, you buy more. So your food has been adulterated. Your food has been tainted right under your very nose and with your tacit approval. The question is, how come the libertarians aren't mad about that?
Well, good question. And how come the American Medical Association is not tying these two things together? I mean, is this incremental on their part, or do they know it? Do they get it? I mean, it's not exactly a secret.
I'm going to tell you, there are different societies that feel differently about this. The American Heart Association is all over this. They came out in 2009 and said, we need to reduce our total sugar consumption to 150 to 200 calories per day, which is 6 to 9 teaspoons per day. The problem is right now we're at 22 teaspoons of added sugar per day. So they want us to reduce our consumption by two-thirds to three-quarters. On the other hand, the American Diabetes Association, when we came out with our study 3 months ago, said, this wasn't even on our radar. We don't even know if this is so. Maybe this needs some study, but we're not going to endorse it or support it. So, you know, here are two different societies, two different medical groups with very different responses to what's going on in our environment.
Well, we're going to be talking after you, Dr. Robert Lustig, about the vote today in the House on the ag bill that went down because of punitive efforts to stop or cut into the food stamp program mm-hmm. that 50 million Americans depend upon.
Right.
But the sad part of that is that and there's some really, you know, very, very cruel politicians who are beating up on poor people who get $1.50 per meal. That's all they're getting. But unfortunately, when you spend that little amount of money on food as is necessary for poor people, they yep. tend to buy sugary stuff that gives them the illusion of nourishment and sustenance.
Indeed. The fact is that sugar is not nutrition. Sugar is energy, but there is not one biochemical reaction in your body that requires dietary sugar. So if you don't need it, and you can live perfectly well without it, and it only causes problems. You know what we call that? We call that a defective product.
That's well, when's is. It going to get recalled?
Well, it's going to be quite a while. But the fact of the matter is, sugar meets the same criteria as tobacco and alcohol in terms of ubiquity, that is, you can't get rid of it, toxicity, that is, if you use it, it's bad for you, abuse, which says that if you know it's addictive and causes continued and increased consumption, and finally, with negative impact on society, since Medicare will be broke by the year 2026 due to chronic metabolic disease driven by sugar that we've shown. So the question is sugar something that needs to be brought under control? And if so, who's going to bring it under control? Well, I guarantee you the food industry will put up every obstacle it possibly can on the road, because this is their juggernaut. This is their way that they've been able to increase their dollars over the past 35 to 40 years.
But, of course, you're talking about corporate food here, and isn't there a divide between corporate food and natural food, if you will? There's a movement to have what's called slow food. People are more
of course.
But that's amongst more educated and affluent. Again,
absolutely right. That everyone thinks that's elitist. You know, here in San Francisco, you know, we're all into that, but everybody thinks we're nuts. The fact of the matter is, you said it yourself, Ian. This, you know, the poor cannot afford anything else. So basically, they're the ones that demonstrate the worst obesity. They're the ones who demonstrate the worst incidences of chronic metabolic disease. They're the ones chewing through the healthcare dollars greatest. And they're the ones who can least afford this, and they're the ones who are being helped the least by this. And the question is, when are we going to turn that around?
Well, then, just in the last couple of minutes, Dr. Robert Lustig, is there a possibility that this change by the AMA declaring obesity a disease, could it backfire in the sense that you don't want to, you know, the term disease is stigmatizing? And surely people who are obese, as I'm saying, they don't need to be stigmatized anymore, do they, obese people?
The fact of the matter is that obesity is the last bastion of pejorativeness that we have in our society. They're the last group you can still make fun of, and all you have to do is listen to Jay Leno each night to realize that. The fact is that we need to fix this problem, and it's even more important to realize that a lot of the obese are perfectly fine. They're perfectly normal. They're healthy. I would rather be fat and fit than thin and sick any day. And for us to continue to give the obese a hard time because of their obesity, recognizing that this is biochemically driven. Obesity is a defect of energy deposition, not a defect of energy balance, because a calorie is not a calorie. What kind of calories dictate what your biochemistry does, and what your biochemistry does dictates whether you end up burning it or storing it. And the problem is our food supply has basically changed our biochemistry. Our environment has changed our biochemistry. And until we change it back, it ain't going to get better.
So we got to start blaming the food suppliers and not those poor obese people you see on television on The Biggest Loser being tortured.
Listen, we have an epidemic of obese six-month-olds. They don't diet and exercise. Are you going to ascribe personal responsibility to them? We have an epidemic of obese newborns. Newborns. If you look at birth weight around the world, it is up 200 grams over the past 20 years. And when you do DEXA scanning to determine body composition, turns out that's all fat. So how come newborns are laying down more fat today? The answer, mother's diet. The question is, can you really blame that newborn for already being fat? Well, if you can't blame the newborn for being fat, you know what? You can't blame anybody for it.
Well, Dr. Robert Lustig, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Again, I was speaking then with Dr. Robert Lustig, a pediatric endocrinologist who spent the last 16 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He's the director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at UCSF, and he's a member of the UCSF Institute for Health Policy Studies and a member of the Obesity Task Force of both the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society. His latest book is Fat Chance: Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the defeat of a punitive bill to cut food stamps.
Oh, to live on Sugar Mountain with the barkers and the colored balloons. You can't be 20 on Sugar Mountain, though you're thinking that you're leaving there too soon. You're leaving there too soon.
Well, they called me once, and they called me twice. The third time they called me was cold as ice. They say, get to the table, get to the table on time. Better make up your mind if you want to get to the table on time.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jim Weil, who's the president of the Food Research and Action Center. Previously, he was program director and general counsel at the Children's Defense Fund and deputy director and director of federal litigation at the Legal Assistance Foundation of Chicago. He litigated major law reform and class action cases in the federal courts of appeals and the Supreme Court on Social Security, Medicaid, AFDC, food stamps, and other public benefits issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Weil.
Thank you, Ian.
And I imagine you're relieved that the farm bill didn't pass because it was going to punish the almost 50 million Americans who go to bed hungry and who don't get enough food. And what I found extraordinary, though, about it is, for example, in the debate that preceded it, Representative Stephen Fincher, Republican of Tennessee, took to quoting the Bible, saying, "The one who is unwilling to work shall not eat." Now, this same Republican congressman from Tennessee, his family owns a cotton farm, and they get the biggest farm subsidies, one of the largest recipients of farm subsidies in Tennessee's history. So that, to me, is just breathtaking hypocrisy.
Yeah, I'd say Representative Fincher probably wasn't the best spokesperson for his cause. But also, what he doesn't understand, and many of the people who want to cut this program don't understand, or deliberately don't understand, is that this is a program, the food stamp program, now called SNAP, reaches a wide swath of Americans who are struggling with poverty and hunger. Seniors, people with disabilities, children, those three groups make up the large majority of beneficiaries, and working-age adults, including a lot of working adults, because wages are so low now that people need food stamps and other help like Medicaid and tax credits to provide the basics for their families. So 60% of the children in the program live in families where a parent is working.
And this is the so-called recovery, where people are probably getting, by and large, getting less than they used to get before the crash.
Right. People's wages are down. Among the people who are working, obviously, there are still fewer people working than before the crash. And those who are working, the bottom half of the population has certainly seen its average wages go down.
So there was a series of amendments that went in before this final vote count, where the bill went down 234 to 195, and it appears that the Republicans wanted even a more punitive bill than the one that they put through, and that they put in a provision that recipients of food stamps had to work.
Right. Well, and there already are some work requirements in the program. Mm-hmm. So the Agriculture Committee, which put the bill together that went to the House of Representatives, was cutting about 2 million people out of the program and reducing benefits for another 500,000 people. And we opposed the bill when just that was happening. But in the floor debate over the last 24 hours, the conservatives made the bill much worse. They put in this drastic, radical work rule that basically gave governors a fiscal incentive to require people to find work or fall off the program even if there were no jobs, and the governors could keep a share of the money that otherwise would have gone to the people for any purpose they wanted, high-end tax breaks, build baseball stadiums, whatever. So that was a bad amendment that got adopted. People were shocked by that. There was an amendment to drug test all applicants in the program, even though there's no evidence that, you know, food stamp applicants are any more likely to be using illegal drugs than anybody else in the society. There are a lot of amendments that are predicated on outdated stereotype, often racially based stereotype of who's in the program, of who needs help, when in fact the people who need help are your neighbors, our neighbors, the people who are working but not making enough, seniors, people with disabilities, and overwhelmingly kids.
But meanwhile, as was the case with the congressman that I mentioned from Tennessee, his farm, his cotton farm, is a huge recipient of these farm subsidies. Now, the Senate and the House bill both agreed what to cut $5 billion, I think, particularly for the most egregious subsidies, which is where you get direct payments for not growing crops. And that apparently has been replaced, though, by a $9 billion crop insurance program. So that seems like a sleight of hand. Can you explain that to us?
To a degree, I can. I'm not an expert in farm programs, but everybody had agreed, most Republicans, most Democrats, the president, most members of Congress, that the direct payment program, which paid farmers often not to grow crops, was just untenable. And so it was agreed to take that money back, in effect. And this is true in the Senate as well as the House. They came back with a vast expansion of the crop insurance program that insures people not just against natural disasters, but against prices going down. And there are many people who think that expansion of crop insurance is going to cost even more than the direct payment program that got eliminated. So that, in effect, there's no cut in the farm subsidies. and you called it a sleight of hand, which is a good description. It's a little bit of a shell game.
Well, but Congressman Finch is in the new proposed $9 billion crop insurance program. It goes to peanuts, cotton, and rice farmers, and he's the biggest cotton farmer and recipient of farm subsidies in the state of Tennessee, in fact, in the history of the state of Tennessee. So
There are a number of members who get farm subsidies, and there are also a lot of members from agriculture areas and who serve on the Agriculture Committee from both parties whose campaign contributions are overwhelmingly from farm interests, crop insurance companies, and otherwise. So you don't have to have a farm to benefit financially from the industry.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Weil, who's the president of the Food Research and Action Center. Previously, he was the program director and general counsel at the Children's Defense Fund and deputy director and director of federal litigation at the Legal Assistance Foundation of Chicago. He litigated major law reform and class action cases in the federal courts of appeals and the Supreme Court on Social Security, Medicaid, AFDC, food stamps, and other public benefit issues. So this extraordinary compulsion to punish the poor, at the same time to brazenly accept taxpayer money in many cases for not even growing crops, for having farms that just literally get subsidies for doing nothing. These people don't see themselves as benefits of government welfare. I mean, is this a case that they're beating up on left-wing welfare and pretending that right-wing welfare doesn't exist?
Well, and to be fair, there are a lot of conservative groups that oppose these farm subsidies. So
the Club for Growth, I take it. And
right, and the Heritage Foundation, I believe. So there's concern among both progressives and conservatives to reform the farm programs, and the president wants to reform them. But most of the energy for cutting back on food stamps, all of the energy for cutting back on food stamps, is coming from the right, and particularly a lot of the new Tea Party members of Congress from districts where there may be thousands of, and probably almost certainly are thousands of food stamp recipients, because hunger and poverty are not, contrary to the stereotypes, concentrated in cities. The food stamp recipient rate is just as high in rural areas in this country as it is in central cities. So the members either aren't quite aware of the economic situation of their constituents, or they're aware but don't care.
Well, a lot of them, of course, wear their religion on their sleeves, and the Sarah Palins and the Michelle Bachmans and others on the Tea Party side use religiosity a lot and proclaim to be custodians of Christian values. How in God's name is it Christian to have your fellow Americans starve and have children go to bed hungry? I mean, we're talking about millions of kids in this country, right? You've got 50 million people dependent upon this program. Isn't the bulk of them children?
Yes. The bulk is, and of course, the mainstream religious groups, the Catholic bishops, Bread for the World, which is a Christian-based anti-hunger group, Mizzone, which is an anti-hunger Jewish charity, the Jewish Council on Public Affairs, and many other religious groups have strongly opposed these cuts. And you know, every major religion in the world has a tenet, a basic tenet, feeding the hungry. And so those members of Congress like Fincher, who quote scripture to justify cutting off help to people, I'm not a biblical expert, but I believe that their religious views are in a tiny minority.
So who were the 24 Democrats that voted for this bill that went down, largely because most of the Democrats opposed it? And by the way, one of the Democrats that voted for it was the number two Democrat in the House, Steny Hoyer of Maryland.
No, Hoyer didn't vote for it. He voted against the bill.
He did? Oh. Yeah. Well, this is the AP story that I'm reading from here. Well,
No, I'm certain he didn't.
Well, that's why I ask you, because it sounded out of character for him.
Right. So the Democrats who voted for it were mostly from rural districts. I don't mean to excuse what any of them did, because as I said, there's a huge amount of hunger and poverty in their districts. They're mostly from rural districts, several from California, where you are.
Do you have any names? I mean, maybe we can shame some of them.
I leave that up to you. Jim Costa, mm-hmm. from California, voted for the bill. Sam Farr from California voted for the bill. John Garamendi voted for the bill.
Oh, well, he's supposed to be a new age touchy-feely guy.
Right, and Jerry McNerney. So four Democrats from California voted for the bill. And, you know, we don't think anybody, Democrat or Republican, should have voted for the bill. Some of the Republican opposition, by the way, was because they thought the cuts weren't big enough. Paul Ryan voted against the bill because he thought the cuts weren't big enough. But overwhelmingly, the Republicans voted for the bill and the Democrats voted against it.
So what's going to happen next then? Because obviously it was a massive humiliation for the Agriculture Committee Chairman Frank Lucas, a Republican of Oklahoma, who tried to shepherd it through. And he seemed
For the ranking Democrat on the committee, Colin Peterson, who made from Minnesota, who made common cause with him.
Right.
And tried to push it through. Well, at this point, they're in such disarray that it's hard to know what's next. The Senate has passed its own bill, which has some food stamp cuts, much smaller, but still...
$400 million annual decrease, yeah, so that's right, one-fifth of the House's
right.
cuts.
Still inappropriate.
Right.
You know, it's possible the Senate will say to the House, well, if you can't pass a bill, just accept our bill, we'll attach it to something that's coming over your way anyhow, although not much is coming over from the Senate, because
right.
they can't pass anything, but... something will have to get passed, and they might try and attach it. Might come up in September in the big budget negotiations when the debt ceiling comes due. So, you know, there's still a huge amount of energy behind getting a farm bill because various farm interests want it and need it very badly. But what today's vote signals is that there's extraordinary Democratic opposition to the food stamp cuts. And while it's probably not the final word or the last battle in the war, it was a huge battle to win because it's going to make it much harder to cut the program or to cut the program significantly. The other thing is the president put out a statement a couple of days ago saying, or the White House did, saying that his senior staff would recommend that he veto the bill that went to the House floor, and that was before it got worse through the amendments. So it was great to have the president take a strong position on this.
So it's possible that there'll be then an extension of the 2008 farm bill that expires in September. That would be the other fallback, right?
That's right.
So, you know, the American people are clearly holding the Congress in increasing disdain, and this is not likely to improve that at all. Are they aware of their dysfunction? That, you know, I mean, obviously it's a good thing that this didn't pass because it's so nasty and punitive and un-Christian indeed. But I imagine it also makes the leadership feel as if, I mean, what's going on with John Boehner? He's supposed to be interested in jobs and helping the American people, and all that ever comes out of his caucus and out of his house are bills to ban abortion, to punish the poor, etc.
Right. Well, you know, he obviously doesn't have much control over his caucus. In the debate today, and particularly on the Republican side, what happened is partially explains why only 10% of Americans approve of Congress. The other thing I'd say about American voters is, in our polling, 70% of Americans say they don't want to see the food stamp program cut at all. And that's true of rural as well as urban voters. The number of women who oppose cuts is slightly higher than the number of men. Republicans oppose cuts, although not as much as Democrats and independents. So across the board, Americans oppose food stamp cuts and certainly these types of cuts. And so this type of madness of slashing away at the program and not just throwing people out of the program and cutting benefits, but trying to put in rules that create red tape and stigmatize people and humiliate them before they can get benefits is not what the American people want.
Well, just in closing, Jim Weil, do you think that that there is a chance in 2014 to change the nature of the House? The normal equation goes against the incumbent in the White House, who's a Democrat. And 2010 was certainly a blowout for the Democrats. Is there going to be a cumulative effect of this kind of stuff, and particularly the nasty nature of what's going on? I mean, if you want a test case for what happens if the Tea Party take over the government, all you have to do is look at the state of North Carolina. And it was the Tea Party people in the House that were particularly punitive and callous in their demands to make people on food stamps, if they can't get a job, the money goes back to the governor, who can then spend it on tax breaks for the rich. I mean, it's just appalling. So what's your reading, since you're there in the Capitol and follow this kind of stuff?
Well, a couple of caveats. One, my political guess may not be better than yours, and mm-hmm. as a public charity, we don't do electoral politics. What I will say is that traditionally, until this year, there's been a lot of bipartisan support for this food stamp program from Republicans as well as Democrats. And we're hoping that the polling and what happened today and generally the broad support for the program among mayors, among state legislators, from industry, there was a lot of outpouring from different interests in support of the program. And there should be support of the program among farmers, that will make both Democrats, including the several from California who voted for the bill, and Republicans better on the food stamp issue. So we need both parties to be better, regardless of who controls the House.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jim Weil.
Well, thank you for covering this. This is a very important to tens of millions of Americans.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Weil, who's the president of the Food Research and Action Center. Previously, he was program director and general counsel at the Children's Defense Fund and deputy director and director of federal litigation at the Legal Assistance Foundation of Chicago. He litigated major law reform and class action cases in the Federal Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court on Social Security, Medicaid, AFDC, food stamps, and other public benefit issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.